Madhu Bhoja Dasar Harha Kukurandaka Rishnibi Atmatuya Baler Guptam Nagnir Boga Ritamiva Madhu Madhu Bhoja Bhoja Dasarha 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 Arha Arha Kukura Kukura Andaka Andaka Vishnibi by the descendants of Rishni Atmatulya as good as himself Balai by strength Guptam protected Nagai by the Nagas Bhogavatim, the capital of Nagaloka. Eva, like. Okay. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. As Bhogavati, the capital of Nagaloka, is protected by the Nagas, so was Dwarka protected by the descendants of Vishnu, Bhoja, Madhu, Dasarha, Arha, Kukura, Andaka, etc., who were as strong as Lord Krishna. So please repeat. As Bhogavati... Actually, why don't you just all read it together? It will be easier. Purport. Nagaloka planet is situated below the Earth planet, and it is understood that the sun rays are hampered there. The darkness of the planet is, however, removed by the flashes of the jewels set on the heads of the Nagas, celestial serpents. And it is said that there are beautiful gardens, revelets, etc., for the enjoyment of the Nagas. It is understood here also that the place is well protected by the inhabitants. So also the city of Dwarka was well protected by the descendants of Vishnu, who were all powerful as the Lord, insofar as he manifested his strength upon this earth. So, the inhabitants of Dwarka are speaking, I think. And last week we read, O Master, if you live abroad all the time, then we cannot look at your attractive face, whose smiles vanquish all our sufferings. How can we exist without your presence? Upon hearing their speeches, the Lord, who is very kind to the citizens of the devotees, entered the city of Dwarka and acknowledged all their greetings by casting his transcendental glance over them. And then it's continued. As Bhogavati, the capital of Nagaloka, is protected by the Nagas, so was Dwarka protected by the descendants of Vishnu, Bhoja, Madhu, Dasarha, Arha, Kukura, Andaka, etc., who are as strong as Lord Krishna. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Could you just speak for a minute on these beautiful names? I don't recognize any of them.
Well, I don't recognize them myself very much. These are... Krishna is coming in the Vrishni dynasty, and so these are all the descendants of Vrishni. They're going back eons and eons and eons, and so these are names of the different dynasties. Madhu, Bhoja, Dasara would be going back to Lord Ram, you know, the father of Lord Ram. And then there's, I don't know about Kukura or Andaka. But the main point is that, you know, the dynasty that Krishna comes in is very powerful as he is. And because that dynasty becomes glorified because of the appearance of the Lord. So it's very special and very powerful. And whatever is protected by the Lord cannot be destroyed. And so the Yadu dynasty was very, very powerful. No one could destroy the Yadu dynasty. Therefore, when Krishna wanted to end his pastimes, he had to find a way to destroy the Yadu dynasty. And basically, the Yadu dynasty destroyed itself, since nobody else was powerful enough to destroy them. So that story is there. It's in the Bhagavatam, and it's also in the Mahabharata, I think.
Is this done in a continuous fashion? Like, next question?
I was going to read the next verse. You know, unless I see something, or somebody has something significant they want to comment upon. And this was a short purport, and basically it's just reiterating what's in the verse. But sometimes different points come up that we want to discuss more in detail. I mean, sometimes they'll just read one verse and one purport. Sometimes they'll read more than that. Sometimes we don't even get to the Bhagavatam on Saturdays, and some other topic has come up and there's been discussion. So is it okay if we continue on to the next verse? Yeah. So text 12. Sarvartur sarvavibhava Punya vriksha latakshramai. Ujjano pavana ramayar Vita padma karashriyam. I'll just read the translation and purport. The city of Dwarkapuri was filled with the opulences of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks and reservoirs of water, breeding lotus flowers all over. Purport. The perfection of human civilization is made possible by utilizing the gifts of nature in their own way. As we find herewith in the description of its opulence, Dwarka was surrounded by flower garlands and fruit orchards, along with reservoirs of water and growing lotuses. There is no mention of mills and factories supported by slaughterhouses, which are the necessary paraphernalia of the modern metropolis. The propensity to utilize nature's own gifts is still there, even in the hearts of modern civilized men. The leaders of modern civilization select their own residential quarters in a place where there are such naturally beautiful gardens and reservoirs of water. But they leave the common men to reside in the congested areas without parks and gardens. Boy, isn't it a fact? Herein, of course, we find a different description of the city of Dwarka. It is understood that the whole dam, or residential quarter, was surrounded by such gardens and parks with reservoirs of water where lotuses grew. It is understood that all the people depended on nature's gifts of fruits and flowers without industrial enterprises promoting filthy huts and slums for residential quarters. Advancement of civilization is estimated not on the growth of mills and factories to deteriorate the finer instincts of the human being, but on developing the potent spiritual instincts of human beings and giving them a chance to go back to Godhead. Development of factories and mills is called ugra karma, or pungent activities, and such activities deteriorate the finer sentiments of the human being and society to form a dungeon of demons. Whoa. We find herein the mention of pious trees, which produce seasonal flowers and fruits. The impious trees are useless jungles only, and they can only be used to supply fuels. In the modern civilization, such impious trees are planted on the sides of roads. Human energy should be properly utilized in developing the finer senses for spiritual understanding, in which lies the solution of life. Fruits, flowers, beautiful gardens, parks and reservoirs of water, with ducks and swans playing in the midst of lotus flowers, and cows giving sufficient milk and butter are essential for developing the finer tissues of the human body. As against this, the dungeons of mines, factories, and workshops develop demoniac propensities in the working class. The vested interests flourish at the cost of the working class, and consequently, there are severe clashes between them in so many ways. The description of Dwarka Dham is the ideal human civilization. Om Gyanat Mirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksun Militam Yena Tasmain Shri Gurave Namaha. So, there's a description of Dwarka is giving here. And it's mentioned, although it's a metropolis, it's a city, it's very beautiful, and it's filled with nature and ponds and lotus flowers and all sorts of flower-bearing trees, flowers that actually produce a smell. And in this kind of environment, you know, the human being can develop human qualities. I mean, the purpose of the human body is to go back home, back to Godhead. It's only in the human form of life that self-realization can occur. And so there's so many different types of forms in this world, but it's only the human being that really is self-aware. You know, animals have some intelligence and some thinking ability, but there's no self-awareness. And so the environment should be such that the human being can awaken to his full potential. It's interesting, I like this statement, and we see it often, that Prabhupada says, sometimes he talks about the tissues of the human body, and how sometimes he mentions it in relationship to prasadam or to milk. He says that milk causes the human tissues to develop, you know, their potential. Or he's mentioning how the environment here is affecting the human tissues either in a positive spiritual way or in a negative way, in a way that causes the human being to forget himself spiritually, not to develop spiritually. And that's an interesting thing to look at.
Garden of Eden, okay, like, you know, it's like paradise, that's fine. But putting myself in its context, like, you know, we're all driving our SUVs and cars and coming here, sitting, reading this, and then driving back. So I really find a conflict within myself. So if I were to truly be God-fearing and really relating to God, should I be on the hills among the flocks of sheep? I mean, this is the conflict I always go through.
Well, this is exactly the point of the purport. And it's the point that I was, if if you allow me, I'll continue to speak on it. And that is, the human tissues. You know, we're affected by the environment. We were talking about in the Bhagavad Gita class, I think you were here Wednesday too, that I like this topic of a script. You know, so you could say that our basic script is our DNA. You know, when we get this material body, and that DNA is coming from generations of very demoniac or very pious, or and so we get that human body. We have the DNA, but then that DNA and that script is also influenced by the environment that it's in. They've done studies on identical twins, and monitoring the brain waves of babies, and it's noticed that if you're in your frontal lobe, if the right side is active, there's a tendency towards negative thinking, depression, and unhappiness, and that even in newborn babies, sometimes newborn babies, their right side is active, sometimes the left side is active. So they've noticed that in newborn babies, when the right side is active, they tend to cry more, they tend to get upset easily, and they're very difficult to pacify. But if their left side is active, they tend to be very happy and, like problem-free children. But then they measure these same brains as the child gets older or later in life, and they see that the baby that might have been right brain active when it was young turns out to be more left brain active when it gets older. So, this it had a particular script when it was born, but it gets modified and gets changed with time by the environment. And sometimes they do it they've done this test with identical twins, right? And the identical twins, because they have the same DNA, they both will be right brain active when they're little babies. But as they grow up, and if they image their brains again, they'll see that they're very, very different, even though they've had the same DNA. And so in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that, what's influencing our DNA or everything in this material world is a combination of the three modes of material nature: goodness, passion, and ignorance. So everything we eat, the environment we're in, so, being in a metropolis, in an environment where there's just factories and where there's cars and there's lots of busyness, that's the mode of passion. We're affected by that. It's not very conducive for peacefulness or for self-realization or for thinking higher thoughts. But we find if we do go out into the countryside, like I invite you all to come to Pacifica, where you get by the mountain and by the ocean, immediately there's a peaceful, calming effect. One starts to feel more space in the mind, and within that space, one can begin to think about God, one can begin to think about self-realization. And therefore, traditionally, yogis and spiritual practitioners, they flock, to where the mode of goodness is prevalent. Sometimes the mode of goodness is compared to dry grass. And the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance is compared to wet wood. And self-realization is compared to starting a fire, and the fire of awakening. Awakening to the fact that you're not the script, you're not this body, and you're not the conditioned script that this body has acquired, Besides the DNA, then we also get a mental script. As when we're born, we have no name. But then we're given a name. And after 2 or 3 years, we actually begin to believe that this name is me. It takes a little time. It doesn't happen all at once. It takes a lot of prompting and a lot of conditioning for us to finally accept this name and accept this body. But by the time we're 2 or 3 years old, We're answering to our name and we're considering everything we see as mine. And then according to our environment, our parents, and the country that we're born in, we develop a certain identity. I'm Indian, I'm American, you know, and Americans, you know, Indians like chili and Americans like, you know, cheese. And so this becomes our conditioning, or our script. And the point of self-realization is to awaken from that script. I mean, all happiness and distress really is going on in the mind. And as long as we're, even if we're so-called, you know, spiritual practitioners, to the degree that we're identified with our mind and with our body, to that degree we're going to suffer. And we won't find the inner spiritual happiness that we're looking for. But as one awakens, then one begins to see that I'm not the mind, I'm not this condition, I'm not the script. And within that realization, there's great freedom. You know, if you're thinking I'm just this, then it's very, very limiting. You're bound. And so in the mode of goodness, the tissues can be positively affected. You know, the physical body and the mind can become favorable for this awakening to occur. So that's compared to dry grass. In dry grass, you can easily catch fire. You know, if you have a log, and it's very, very dry, if you put it next to a burning log, it can start fire right away. So a burning log is compared to someone who's already self-realized. In their association, you can also catch fire if you're dry. But if you're very wet, then you can also catch fire, but it may take a long time. First, you have to dry out. Mm-hmm. In the science of fire, I've mentioned this before because I used to be a firefighter. We used to study fire. And that when something burns, just like if this started to burn, we would think that this wood, because this is made of wood, I think, we think that the wood is burning, but that's not actually accurate. What's actually burning is the gas. And gas can become flammable, but a solid actually can't burn. But what happens is that if you put this wood next to a flame, it becomes so hot that eventually the molecules break apart and they become gaseous. And at that point, there can be a flame. So if you put a wet log next to a burning log, after a long period of time, eventually the log will dry out, then it will become very hot, and then it will turn to gas, and then it will combust. So in the mode of goodness, when one lives a life in the mode of goodness, that's very, very favorable for self-realization. And in that environment, self-realization can occur much more readily than an environment that's steeped in the mode of passion and in the mode of ignorance. So in the Gita, Krishna explains in the 14th chapter, in the 17th chapter, and also in the 18th chapter, what are the qualities of ignorance, what are the qualities of passion, what are the qualities of goodness in relationship to this material world, in relationship to the body, in relationship to the food, in relationship to the outer environment. Even trees, even animals, some are more in the mode of passion, more in the mode of goodness, more in the mode of ignorance. There's always a combination of the modes going on, but one mode will be more prevalent than the other. So tigers, you know, they're very passionate, and I had a dream of a tiger last night. That's what I'm thinking about. It was attacking me, too. And then I woke up. But cows are non-aggressive, you know, peaceful. And monkeys, they're very troublesome. But the foods we eat are also, you know, You know what Krishna says about the different foods? Can anyone think?
Avoid aphrodisiacs.
Avoid aphrodisiacs, yes. But Krishna, he talks about food. What foods are in the mode of goodness, what foods are in the mode of passion, what foods are in the mode of ignorance. Maybe we should look it up. I think it's in chapter 18. Or maybe it's chapter 17. I think it's chapter 17. So these are, food directly affects our tissues. That's why I'm thinking of this one. Our bodily tissues. So I think chapter 17, Krishna talks about the foods.
So effectively, should it be dry is what is recommended?
Huh? Well, that was just in case if you want to start a fire with a log. The tissue means that we should, the food we eat should be in the mode of goodness. The music we listen to should be in the mode of goodness. The people we associate with should be in the mode of goodness. The place we live should be in the mode of goodness. Everything, our external environment as much as possible, should be in the mode of goodness. And if we connect it with God, with Krishna, then it can be transcendental. So, therefore, if you offer food in the mode of goodness to Krishna, it becomes spiritualized, then it becomes prasadam. Or instead of listening to classical music, which is in the mode of goodness, we can listen to kirtan, which is transcendental to the mode. So this immediately will affect our brain, our physical brain, and our subtle mental body, and eventually contact the soul and inspire it, elevate it. But I'm just looking for... 17.8. Huh? 17.8. What page?
688.
Okay. Yeah, got it. So here's an example of food, how food would affect this. So Krishna says, this is 17.8, text 8. Foods dear to those in the mode of goodness increase the duration of life, purify one's existence, and give strength, health, happiness, and satisfaction. Such foods are juicy, fatty, wholesome, and pleasing to the heart. And then food, text 9, foods that are too bitter, too sour, salty, hot, pungent, dry, and burning are dear to those in the mode of passion. Such foods cause distress, misery, and disease. And then text 10, food prepared more than 3 hours before being eaten. Food that is tasteless, decomposed, putrid, and food consisting of remnants of untouchable things is dear to those in the mode of darkness. So here's just one example of how our environment will affect us either positively, meaning in, you know, will help us spiritually elevate, or negatively cause us to become more and more identified with this body, with this mind, and with this script. And then we'll be making our next script according to the attachments and aversions that we develop while we're in this life. We'll be making the script of our mental body. And then again, we'll get a physical body that will reflect that script, and then the process continues. So we want to be in a situation where we have the opportunity to awaken and get out of the cycle of birth and death and go back home, back to Godhead. So it's been an interesting morning because we started off reading the Brahma Samhita, and in that verse it actually describes, you know, how you... you know, how you go to the spiritual world and what kind of form you get when you get there, what kind of spiritual script you get, eternal script. And then today in the purport, Prabhupada is mentioning how this modern civilization is counterproductive and is causing us to become more and more Demoniac, yeah, demoniac. Demoniac meaning, you know, that going away from God, not to God. So in the opposite direction, you know, or ignorance, or darkness and light. So one is the path of light, the other is the path of darkness. And the path of darkness always means unhappiness and more suffering. And the path of light means freedom from suffering, really, and real happiness. So, Krishna consciousness is a lifestyle. It's a yoga lifestyle, really. And it's a 24-hour, you know, 7-day-a-week process. And the first thing we want to do is dry out so we can catch fire. And then, according to the love we develop for Krishna, spontaneously, we'll attain that form.
Srila Prabhupada say actually that one has to be in the mode of goodness for becoming self-realized or for spiritual advancement. I remember something
about that. Would you like to comment on? You did say that one has to be associated with things that are in the mode of goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, one needs to be in that mode for further advancement. Say one is a mode of passion, let's say, in the world out there, and still trying to do devotional service or going to the temple, that the chances of such an individual rising are less than one who would be in the mode of goodness.
Yeah, I mean, because again, we started out by saying that bhakti reaches down to the lowest and brings one to the highest. So there's no qualification for taking a bhakti except for faith. But nonetheless, you know, having said that, you know, if we're trying to start a fire and at the same time pouring water on it, then it takes longer to do that. And according to our scripts and according to the association that we've had up till this point, you know, it may be easier or more difficult for someone to take to the process of self-realization and bhakti. And we can go through the routines of our practice. But if we're like the elephant that, you know, takes a bath and then goes back onto the land and covers itself with dirt, then it, you know, it takes more time. There is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that sort of alludes to this, 1854, which will be in the sloka book, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasoshati Nakankshati Samasaveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhaktim Labhate Param. So Krishna is describing one who's awakened, self-realized. He's Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma. He's very satisfied in that spiritual awakening. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasoshati Nakankshati. He doesn't desire anything in this world anymore. He's not hankering for anything. He's not lamenting about anything. We spend most of our days waiting for something in the future to come or lamenting about something that in the past that didn't happen. But the Brahma Bhuta self-realized soul, he's in this moment. His attention is in the present, and he's experiencing the joy of the self. And he's not in the mind. He's not living in the world of the mind. He knows that the future and past are both illusions, and so he's experiencing pleasure from moment to moment, pleasure of the self. And so, no hankering, no lamentation. And he also sees all living entities are the same. Oh, they're just like me. And Krishna says that person can take the devotional service. So if one is in that state, one catches fire right away. But if we're still under the modes of nature, this is explained in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, we can actually practice devotional service and still be in the modes of material nature. So it's not pure bhakti. Just like, you know, we can be doing leading a kirtan or giving a class or cleaning the floor, but our consciousness will determine, you know, the quality of the bhakti. Right? So if we're cleaning the floor because somebody put our name on the cleaning list and we really don't want to do it and we're doing it in a grudging mood, well, we are doing service for the deities, but the mood is in the mode of ignorance.
Just another comment that it's of interest, you were mentioning about DNA forming the script for a person at the time they are born. Just now, and I came across, in fact, this week, in the Time magazine, they had a cover story on this area called epigenetics, they say. DNA is genetics, and the influence of environment on expression of DNA is epigenetics. Mm-hmm. So they talk about how now they are finding that environment has such a big role in influencing the expression of genes. Mm. Two people may, like twins that you were mentioning, have the same genes when they are born, but that with time as they grow, depending on the environment, it actually influences how their genes are expressed, and that determines then the behavior. So the script changes with the environment. It may be also related to genes in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to qualify that when one awakens, when one is Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma, even though the body, the genes are doing their thing, and the mind is doing its thing, the self-realized soul is not identified anymore. So he's not, even though the body may be continuing its course, and there may be pleasures and there may be pains, or there may be attachment and aversions of impressions in the mind, the self-realized soul clearly sees that he's not the mind and he's not the body, and he's still enjoying the pleasure within, even though externally the body appears to be going through its course. And so that is all attainable. We don't have to wait to leave our body to experience the bliss within, you know, and our relationship with the Supreme Lord, even though the body is going to go on and continue its course until it finishes. And the impressions may still be there in the mind from past lives and in this life. One doesn't have to be affected by them anymore. So, it's after 10, huh? 10:10? Okay. So let us end the class here. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.